Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I am your host, Nicholas Lorimer, joined today by Sargon. Sara, how are you doing?
Thank you. Well, thank you, not then, Nicholas.
I'm also joined today by Makone Maja. Makone, how are you?
Hello. Very happy to be here with you both.
Indeed, thank you for being on today to both of you. Let's get right into the news of the day, and the first story we're going to talk a little bit about is what's going on with the MK party. Yes, I know we've talked a lot about MK recently, but it just seems to be able to keep generating sort of quite interesting headlines. And last week we talked a little bit about there were these rumors and allegations from unnamed sources that Jacob Zuma was suffering from a bit of fatigue or maybe some stress to his age and health problems. But over the weekend, we've had a bunch of dramatic things happening. There was a purge of MK leaders, I think, in the youth organization that began, I think it was either last week or the week before. And now we've seen the founder of the party, a guy who was called Jabulani Khumalo, kicked out of the party, apparently by Jacob Zuma, along with four other senior figures from its leadership structure over allegations of suspicious dealings with the ANC. There's also been an allegation from someone who claims to have been a senior official in the MK party, a guy called Lennox Ntsondo, that the party forged its signatures that would see it registered to appear on the 2024 ballot. This, of course, would mean that the party was illegally registered if this turns out to be true. He specifically says that the team managed to scrape a bunch of information from a, I think, a City of Cape Town employment database, Cape Metro Council, and job seekers and database, and then used those details to fill out the signatures for the political party. He swore an affidavit to this effect in the Western Cape. So I guess the first question, Sarah, is what exactly is going on with MK? Jacob Zuma has made a lot of noise about how they are getting rid of unethical, dodgy, or traitorous elements within the party. I mean, is this just because there was some sort of disagreement over what role Jabulani Khumalo would have, considering he apparently started the party on instructions from Jacob Zuma? Maybe he thought he was going to get some sort of better reward for it. And now that Jacob Zuma is officially the leader of the MK party, maybe there was some sort of disagreement about how the spoil should be divided up. I don't know. Sarah, what do you make of this?
You'll have to forgive me for starting with the old phrase, a pot calling a kettle black. I mean, Jacob Zuma being concerned about ethics and double dealings and side hustle with the ANC and stealing money that was meant for the party to use on luxury goods like cars. I would have thought these just met the criteria of membership of the party, but far be it from me to be too cynical about these things, but you have to admit that it almost that's its manifesto. I mean, surely that is its manifesto, but apparently not. Apparently, just wants to nationalize everything and take everything and whatever, all part of the same manifesto. But I think, given the fact that you really are looking at a party that I don't think anyone thought was made up of anything other than liars, cheats, and scumbags in general, this would be true to form. But if anyone thought they were going to form a party with Jacob Zuma and not be on the receiving end of his displeasure for whatever reason, Jacob Zuma is a much tougher character than that, and he will be relying on a reputation that absolutely nobody else within that party comes close to having. I mean, I don't think any of us, as sort of casual observers, know anybody else in the party. So in a way, it's I think it's classic Jacob Zuma stamping his authority. I think it also helps to make him look tough when there are rumors about ill health and missing rallies, perhaps because of it or allied to it or not because of whatever the case may be. It's him stamping his authority because having got through all the challenges so far that the ANC has made against him, he's in a very strong position. And as we discussed earlier, even with the alleged forging of signatures. It's a very difficult one for the IEC to begin to deal with timeously, if at all, if they have the, and I'd question whether they have the capacity to deal with it. So I think it's a combination of Jacob Zuma sending out a warning to all and sundry that he shall not be crossed. He's passed, he sort of crossed his Rubicon of issues to deal with, and he is the man.
So, McCorner, what do you make of this? I think it's really showing that MK is, in many ways, kind of overtaken the EFF as the most chaotic potential political actor in this election. Firstly, they came out of sort of nowhere to poll much higher, I think, than anyone expected. You know, I was expecting them around 5%, but they're polling at like somewhere between 10 and 13%, depends on what poll you look at. We still obviously don't know how they're going to perform on election day. They sort of come out of nowhere. They're not being led by Jacob Zuma. Jacob Zuma then emerges, takes over the party, and immediately there's all sorts of infighting and skullduggery going on behind the scenes, people getting thrown out, fired, the person who actually created the party getting fired. Then there's all these rumors about Zuma being ill, not being in a good position to campaign. And you kind of wonder, like, where is this all going to end up? I could easily see the MK party doing sort of somewhere north of 15% if they were very lucky, if the ANC has a really bad time, or, and I think this is more likely, kind of shrinking a bit before the election, not being nearly as big of a player as we think they're going to be right now. What do you make of all this?
I think Sarah's classic Jacob Zuma is just about right. And I want to say that if the ANC is behind this, right, the leaking of these stories about Zuma's ill health or whether or not the MK party fraudulently collected signatures, be it true or not, if the ANC is behind it, all they're doing is just propelling the MK into bigger and bigger success. They were basically irrelevant until they plastered Jacob Zuma's face across all their posters and rallies. But they've also benefited exponentially from all the exposure the ANC's given them in the media, right? Much like the DA and Ryzen Zandi's beef has just only grown Ryzen Zandi's stardom bigger and bigger. I think that if the ANC is behind this, that they are achieving the opposite of what they had hoped, which is that Jacob Zuma, the ultimate spin doctor, is only going to use these narratives to position himself favorably among his voters and his constituencies. Let's not forget, this is the man that cooked up the words, the term white monopoly capital in a lab with Bill Pottinger that has since become an important lexicon, an important word in the political discourse lexicon. So I do think that he's able to spin all narratives in his favor. And this is certainly going to be one, whether it's the allegation of fraudulent signatures or this idea that he is in ill health. But yeah, it's quite tricky there, Nick, to put a number on the potential outcome of the votes, particularly in KZN, because he has such a strong supporter base there. But I'm also quite interested to see exactly where it ends, if he makes it out alive, if it is indeed true that he is in ill health. Where does it place the Mkhondoa party, and also how does it displace the ANC as well as the IFP and all the other parties that were sort of an emerging threat to the ANC in KZN? How does the MK's emergence displace them in that region?
Yeah, it's very difficult to tell. Also, one does wonder, you know, I saw some analysts making a claim, I can't remember who it was, the MK party had already been established to such a degree that it would go on past Jacob Zuma's leadership of the party, you know, if he decides to step down off tomorrow or something. But I don't think that's even vaguely reasonable a thing to suggest. So far, there's, and especially when you purging everyone else who seems to have any kind of profile in the party, that really speaks to me that this is far more like the EFF going to be something of a cult of personality. I mean, we'll have to see. I have heard some people say to me that there's a lot of sort of some traditional leaders in places like KZN and some sort of church groups as well that have supported Zuma. So that may suggest there's a little bit more infrastructure to the party, but so far, it's still got all the hallmarks of something that is very much a personal vehicle kind of thing. I must say that MK has been quite impressive in its ability, and you know, you can see this in other political leaders around the world. I sort of think of Trump, for example. Of it doesn't, even if you have a very adversarial relationship with much of the media, you can actually sometimes use that to your advantage to catapult you into the headlines. And you know, it's not just on this show. We really have seen in the headlines for the past couple of months, the MK party really getting a lot of media attention, despite the fact that we still don't know how well they're actually going to do on election day. Sarah, any final thoughts on this one before we move on?
I think he, you know, I have this image of him, Trump, and Silvio Berlusconi, the late. Those sort of characters where almost part of their perverse attraction is the fact that they are bulletproof because they don't hide their hypocrisy and their no goodness under a bushel. It is almost part of their magnetism. And whatever happens in this election, I presume that in 5 years' time, Zuma himself personally will be a spent force if he hasn't succumbed to illness. And I think there's a very strong likelihood in that event, particularly with the purges, that the MK party, if it does okay, will not necessarily be see out to the next election or through the next election. It's cope.
Yeah. I just want to say on this on the subject of Silvio Berlusconi that he, I think, had the most Italian injury I've ever heard of in my life, which was, I think, during a political rally, someone hit him with a marble statue, which that just, I'd recommend anyone with some time to kill to go and read Silvio Berlusconi's political career on his Wikipedia page. It is, man, it's a wild ride.
I mean, did you see how he was buried? I mean, his funeral. Yeah. Was fantastic.
No, Matt, there are every now and again there comes along a political figure who is so bizarre and wild and wacky that they make a splash even far outside of their own country. Anyway, let us move on to our next story, and this is many people have talked, at least many people back in 2018, 2019 talked about Cyril Ramaphosa and the reform agenda and how South Africa's economy was going to be shifted in the right direction. And well, I think that narrative is pretty much dead and buried, but we're only seeing further confirmation of that. Apparently, according to Sakalika, the government is proposing new regulations for the real estate sector, which will ensure that something like 40% of real estate agencies around the country fall afoul of BEE legislation and will not necessarily be able to practice their business legally. So according to the reporting, real estate agents and agencies will have to henceforth comply with level 8 BEE scores to obtain or renew Fidelity Fund certificates. Without these certificates, they cannot legally do business. Up until now, you only needed a valid BEE certificate, which meant that you just needed a certificate demonstrating your, I don't know, racial makeup or whatever. But even if you didn't actually make the criteria to qualify for BEE, you could still get your license, so to speak. But according to Sakalika, the new regulations will put a damper on this. They say that this could disrupt 2,400 of the 6,200 real estate agencies. Pete LaRue of Sakalika said, of the 40,000 certificates issued, 30,000 were to white people, 10,000 to black, colored, and Indian people, to reflect the demographics of this country as what the government says its goal is. One would require the white group to decrease to either 1,000 or for non-white property practitioners to increase to 300,000, one of which involves draconian legislation to basically crush many real estate agents, and the other one is very unlikely to happen because of how poorly the economy is doing. You're not going to see a huge increase in the number of black real estate agents anytime soon. In particular, so I think level 8 BEE certificates are the lowest level of ownership. I think it's like 10% or something. I'm not entirely sure how the scorecards work, so take that with a pinch of salt. But the businesses that will be worst affected by this are exactly the smaller real estate agencies, where you have, you know, maybe a mother and a daughter, or a father and his nephew or something like that, running a real estate agency because it's, you know, they, you know, it's a small operation. They can't just bring on a new partner for the sake of some sort of racial quota. Makone, what do you make of this story? This just seems like another ideological boneheaded thing that's going to cause a lot of problems for a sector of the economy and not really help anyone's lives particularly.
Agreed. I think usually when we talk about expropriation or even expropriation without compensation, we usually limit it to land, right? Land seizures by the government that somehow going to be cut up many ways to make land equitably accessible to people. But I do think redistributive policies like BEE, like the NHI, that seek to either take the pool of money that people put their hard-earned money into to be able to get high quality medical services, or a company that you started and must now give a share of it away to like somebody that has it has nothing to do with the daily operations of your company, right? That giving away of that share to said individuals is a form of expropriation. And these redistributive policies, like you indicated, Nick, tend to work for a very few select people, not even the people who are the objects of its target, right, which is broader masses of Black people. It also, I don't see how this redresses anything, because, of course, these redistributive policies operate under the guise that, you know, they are remedying the past oppressions of apartheid. But I don't see how giving 10% or 20% of somebody's business to completely said separate group of people, instead of empowering those group of people to start their own businesses or create the sort of environment that when Black people want to come up and set up their own companies, they're able to flourish. Instead of dealing and addressing those problems, they go the easy route, right? Easy for them, of course, to just redistribute, call it wealth of, again, another fewer group of people. But yeah, I think this is definitely a form of expropriation that is often not discussed, using that sort of language about redistribution and whether it actually benefits the people who it's meant to.
Right. This is exactly what's so sort of twisted about all this, is that the number of Black South Africans to benefit from this will probably be very small. Because, you know, you'll have some very big companies who are either already BEE compliant or will be able to, you know, bring on some BEE partners without too much cost to them. But you'll get sort of smaller businesses getting hampered by this, wiped out, having to do go arounds, find some other way to keep operating legally. And the vast majority of people in this country who are entrepreneurs wanting to start a business will not see a single change in their lives whatsoever, even if they want to be a real estate agent. This is very much just crushing a sector with likely almost no positives. Sara, what do you make of this story?
What's very concerning is that in the past few months, the ANC has really doubled down on legislation that is narrowing the field through BEE. I mean, a double down in a, you know, just as criticism is really increasing from largely unexpected quarters about the way the government has imposed BEE for all the reasons Makone has given. But it's doubling down. The Procurement Amendment Act, is a wonderful example of a bad legislation being made very much worse, increasing the whole idea of the middleman. And it's almost like revenge by legislative fiat. And on the one hand, it smacks of the sort of autocratic impulse within the ANC. On the other hand, I think it also does smack of the sort of an element of revenge against the plethora of criticism that's followed the failure by the ANC to govern the govern this country properly, and the tendency to penalize people for doing good in the sense of training youngsters or getting people onto the ladder or whatever it realistically takes to go get people into the workplace and into the economy. And it's probably all of those things wrapped together and thrown into one. The problem, of course, is now is the time that businesses as a party to the political dynamic in South Africa has got to actually start really opposing this sort of measure, ignoring it, but not following it up, but you know, really get some heft behind it, make it an organized thing. There are plenty of alternatives that could achieve in a much better way what theoretically governmental BEE is supposed to do. And that is not, the IRR has suggested it on numerous times and repeatedly. So in other words, the business sector, large and small, can offer a real alternative to developing people from a point of disadvantage in this country. And this is not the way to do it, because as McConney says, it's once again, it's a few people being financially benefited who add nothing, who learn nothing, who take nothing from it but the money. And that's creepy.
Yeah, if you really want to change the lives of Black South Africans, may I suggest growing the economy in such a way that more Black South Africans can afford houses? I don't think it's really particularly important who sells it. if you can own your own house because you have a stable income. That's what most South Africans want. And that's precisely what this policy will not make much of a difference in changing. McCorney, any final thoughts on this story?
Or that you create the sort of environment that Black and white businesses alike can thrive, which at present is not. If our problem is that we have too few Black realtors or real estate companies, how about we incentivize Black people to start companies instead of superimposing them onto white-owned companies? That feels one hostile, too punitive, like Sarah said. And I think that Black people also want to grow their own companies from scratch. There's a lot of meaning that comes from that I don't think you can quite afford people when you just elevate them into a position that they did not even deserve to begin with.
Right. Earned success is one of the gateways to happiness, whereas the other way around is not likely to really improve your own mental state much. So even those who benefit from this probably, in a sense, won't actually benefit as much as the legislation wants them to. Anyway, let's move on to our last story. And this is a debate that has come up time and time again about the South African national minimum wage. The reason that this has gotten into the news is because the DA has been under attack for their proposal with regards to the national minimum wage. The DA says that the national minimum wage right now is too high, and that their plan is, particularly in sort of sectors like manufacturing, their plan is to essentially stop increasing it so that this will phase it out over time, because as inflation goes up, that minimum wage will become less and less of an obstacle towards people hiring workers. They also had this proposal that I think you can get a job seeker certificate if you are being unemployed for, I think it's 12 months or something like that, to be able to say to a company, look, I haven't been able to find a job for a while. Please give me a job. Using the certificate, I waive my right to get a minimum wage, and then you can get some work experience, because there's pretty good, the idea behind that is there's pretty good evidence that the thing that makes you more likely to get a job after losing one job is that you've had a job before. Whereas if you're consistently unemployed through your life, it reduces the chance that you'll ever have a job every year that you're unemployed. So that's kind of the idea of this, is that to get people into the workforce with and be able to get at least some experience and some income, rather than the shockingly high, over 40% unemployment we currently suffer from. One of the highest, if not the highest, in the world. SATU has come in a big way to attack this, saying that this is out of touch, that it's serving the interests of evil capitalists, that this is a attempt to disenfranchise the working class, roll back the gains of the post-apartheid era, and increase inequality. There's also this belief that Kosatu proposes that when you pay people more in minimum wage, that it stimulates the economy, because then they go and spend that money. Now, I have a lot of sympathy myself for this particular proposal of the DA. I think that it is, both sides here can come up with studies of different levels of quality that will tell you the minimum wage is good or the minimum wage is bad. But I think it's very difficult to argue that firstly, our current labor laws are working at all. And secondly, that in a country where almost half of people and something like 70% of young people are unemployed, that you should not be making it as easy as possible, as cheap as possible to hire people for work. It sucks to work for a very low wage. It can be very stressful and difficult on someone's life. Sometimes it won't necessarily cover all of your costs that you need to live on, but it's certainly better than sitting at home with no money, trying to scratch a living from hustling or from making a little bit of money from, you know, like your grandmother's pension, or just sort of clinging to life in the terrible, miserable way that so many South Africans are forced to do these days. Makwana, do you agree with me? What do you make of this debate?
I agree. And I actually watched the conversation between, I think it was Cuthbert from the DA, and I believe his surname is Parks from COSATU, on Newsroom Africa. And there were two discussions being had there. One is the DA trying to make an argument about their proposal for cutting back minimum wage through the certificate. And the other is the COSATU member using language of care. Like, the DA does not care about workers, right? Which is like manipulation in politics class 101. As you could tell that there are two different discussions being had there, and that appealing to people by actually using logic and trying to illustrate that minimum wage is ultimately beneficial to people and small and medium-sized companies alike, it's not going to be effective, because he was playing all the games you can think of: victimhood, racial, because he was appealing to those apartheid narrative, saying that the DA has opposed virtually every pro-worker legislation since all the way back to apartheid. And you can tell he's in the manipulation game. But I do agree that minimum wage is ultimately fatal to upcoming entry-level jobs in South Africa, and that doing away with it in exchange for something like that certificate, where people voluntarily waive their right to a minimum wage and say, speak for themselves, advance through self-agency, advance their own interests and say, this legislation is actually holding me back from job opportunities, I would rather relinquish that in exchange for a job. It's a great indicator of whether people want the minimum wage or not. And I think that ultimately it should come down to that the people should self-represent themselves, and that this certificate is an excellent way of doing that. But I do think that typically when these conversations come up, there are different chats that are being had where appealing to emotion is obviously stronger than making these logical proposals about the detriments of something like a minimum wage.
Sarah, I think unemployment, and this is a view shared by the large number of South Africans, is unemployment is really the greatest crisis facing this country. It is so destructive to people's lives, not just in the lack of money, but also in the lack of people's kind of engagement in society and their own feelings of self-worth and their own sort of hope for the future, that their life, that their children's lives or even their lives 10 years from now will be different. I think we should be doing everything we can to reduce unemployment. And clearly, the way that things are currently working has not happened to do that. I mean, so for COSATU to sit there, who represent an ever shrinking percentage of South Africans, and sort of say that they are the authentic voice of the working class, is, I think, kind of ridiculous.
Well, you see, I think the problem is that something COSATU, I suppose, any organization that is sort of stuck in a communist economic mindset doesn't understand is that if your economy is shrinking and people are being retrenched, as is being threatened across the mining industry, your constituency, which is an elite but compared to the unemployed, your constituency, which is the employed person, is disappearing. And they're not being replaced because you don't think it's a good idea for them to get on the ladder to succeed through an agreement to earn less than is stipulated. There is something so sick about the desire to remove people's agency in every aspect of their lives, to make them powerless to change their own life. And that's why every survey the IRR has done, certainly in the last 15 years, it doesn't matter how many criteria people put forward as the most problematic in their lives of a list of, say, 12 or 14 on average, unemployment is the only one that is always at the top of the list. And what the DA is trying to do, and I think most people or many people will appreciate this, because the ANC, as one commentator said, and the ANC and the EFF certainly don't understand it, but the sheer cruelty of assuming that somehow you are entitled by virtue of your high position that you may or may not fill with any competence determines what happens to people in their ordinary lives is, it's actually breathtaking. It's actually breathtakingly horrible. And it's got to be core to why there are no successful communist economies in the world currently. And the China is not the example to look at. I mean, that's, you know, we're looking at crony capitalism and smart people, you know, playing the game. It's not the same thing. This is old-fashioned ideology that is absolutely pickled in aspic. And the value of getting onto the ladder of being able to improve your lives, your life, is worth the sacrifice you make in not getting a job because they can't pay you the minimum wage anyway.
So just on that point of just having micromanaging people's lives, I mean, I've been told by an MP that in discussions on essentially black ownership of companies, that ANC and EFF MPs have quite literally argued that black shareholders should not have the same rights to sell their shares as other holders of companies, because they don't want them to sell the company's shares away in return for money, because they'll spend it on bad things, and so it must remain in black hands, which is racist, micromanaging, stupid. It's just it boggles the mind that this is the sort of ideological approach that has dominated so much of our economic policy for the last at least 10 years, if not longer. Makone, any final thoughts on this one?
To what you said, Nick, I've actually also seen a stat recently that says that black ownership of land has also declined over the years. I wonder why the ANC hasn't intervened there to say that, because they need it to appear as though black people want land. Why should it not? It should bar them from being able to sell that land so that it can maintain those vanity metrics that make it appear as if what they are trying to advance through policies simultaneously what black people want. But of course, when those two things defy each other, there's a lot of micromanagement that comes in place there. But I also think that what the DA are trying to do is broaden the tent, right? Because we know that there are government internships that pay below minimum wage, right? They pay stipends under 5,000 Rand. And the DA is saying, instead of the government gatekeeping this, how about we open it up to everyone so that companies too can get into employing masses of people?
I should have mentioned that as well. It's the Expanded Public Works Program, which is essentially allowing people kind of low level work just to get a foot into some work experience, get a little bit of money that the government runs, pays less than minimum wage. So clearly on some level, the government already understands this argument. Anyway.
Democracy with a capital H.
Mm, absolutely.
Exactly. Okay, let us go on to our last story. We're going to very briefly touch on this one. And this is about a terrible thing happening in Iran. So of course, Iran has been a very unfree country for a very long time. Arguably its whole history. But the Iranian regime in Iran has taken this to a new level ever since the murder of Mahsa Amini, who was a young Kurdish woman who was killed by the religious police in Iran for not wearing her hijab correctly, her hair covering, as is mandated by Iranian law. There have been major protests in Iran against the government and the policy of enforced hijab wearing. These have been very often met with extreme amounts of violence, not just on the streets in terms of the suppression by the police, sometimes shooting dead of protesters, but also in the legal system of Iran, where large numbers of the protesters' leaders have been sentenced to death or lengthy imprisonment. The most recent one is a rapper called Tumaj Salehi, who was spoke publicly out in favor of the protests, He was then charged with sort of contravening the national security laws. He was put on trial. His original ruling found him guilty and sentenced him to death, although that was overturned in an appeals court. Once let out of prison after the, while he was, I think, awaiting his imprisonment, he spoke publicly about how, while in prison, the Iranian government had tortured him seriously. After that, he was charged with undermining national security on a slightly different law, and he has been sentenced to death by hanging. It's very likely to be hanged in the not too distant future. There have been major protests both within Iran against this, as well as criticism by foreign countries, particularly in the West. Sara, really terrible story, this, and the kind of Iran is sort of almost, I think, kind of forgotten in the news stories. It sort of flashes up on foreign media news for a little bit, and then people just kind of forget about it, even though this crisis has been ongoing now for at least 18 months.
No, I think it's what it serves to remind us that the only hanging that should be doing, that should be happening, is that the leadership of the Western world should be hanging its head in shame. It doesn't understand the nature of a essentially apocalyptic theocracy that is always cruel when it feels undermined or threatened. In this case, I think it's hoping that it can get away with its misdeeds by what's happening in Gaza and on the northern border of Israel. But it's not to forget that, you know, the whole idea of appeasing Iran to bring it into the tent from a Western point of view is a mistake. It just is. It's not how a regime like that operates. We are in 7 October. It was been planned for a decade, and Iran, through its directly and through its proxies, have been training Hamas to do what it did, and now they're camped around Israel. And Iran, as I say, is an apocalyptic theocracy. It sees the destruction of Israel as a foretaste of the destruction of the West, which is the enemy of that extreme jihadism that is, I mean, it's very prevalent in the Middle East, but it is, Iran will literally, the mullahs will send Iranians to their death to achieve the perfect afterlife. We don't understand.
And I mean, you get a sense of just how committed the regime is to its ideology by the fact that you'd think that some sort of mild reform along the lines of, you know, not forcing people to wear hijabs in public, which in some Iranian cities has actually become increasingly the norm as people have kind of joined these protests. And yet even on this relatively small point, the regime has decided to kind of pin its entire identity and legitimacy and book no opposition. McCorney, any final thoughts on this before we close?
I do think that, and I had to look up this rapper myself, learned that he spoke out in his raps, in his music, against the Iranian government's corruption, that he was 33 years old, so fairly young guy. I think a lot of the denial of civil liberties in the Middle East is typically met with death, like the inevitable hanging of this unfortunate young rapper. And it tends to sort of not spark any revolution from the citizens of these countries. But I do think that differently from, say, the lady who opposed the public wearing of a hijab, differently from her, this guy spoke out against the politics, right, rather than the religion of Iran. And I hope that that will cause the sort of uprising that you saw in the spring, in the Tunisian protests, the spring uprisings, right, where people were basically defending themselves against similarly corrupt government, that they could not get jobs because of the government's corruption. So I'm hoping that and it tends to happen that rappers' deaths propel their stardom further and bigger, that this hanging of this guy, the martyring of this guy, achieves the same thing that you've seen across Western countries.
Yeah, it's, I mean, many Iranians have been trying to overthrow the regime now for quite a while. And so far, it seems as though the Iranian regime has remained very resilient, even though it's not clear whether it actually does maintain major popular support or whatever. Its control of the levers of violence are very, very strong. But yes, that's a much longer discussion for another day. Anyway, thank you very much, everyone, for watching. We shall see you soon. I hope you all have a wonderful day. Cheers, everyone.